Okay, good morning, everyone. Actually, I think I'm going to stand. I feel more comfortable at this distance standing. I hope that's okay. Thank you very much for having me. I looked at your website a bit of the shul, and I say that before I came here, I felt at home, because I think many of your ideals are those that I share, my family shares, my own keila in Chashmonaim. That's in the religious sense. I think in the more national and cultural sense, in terms of many values, also share values with Yad Vashem, and I don't think it's coincidental that Simon Bentley, who is so prominent in the activities of this congregation, is also has also been and continues to be so prominent in Yad Vashem UK. So I thank him in absentia. I already did, and I will, but I appreciate very much that he made this shidduch, which was, nothing's coincidence, right? So it turned out that I was in the United Kingdom. My previous time here was about 8 years ago, and that was not for things having to do with Yad Vashem, because I was at the event that this little notebook was given out at, and it's the plenary of the UK presidency of an organization called IHRA, the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance. And I think most of what I'll be talking about with you today has to do with the commonalities and also some of the differences in our time, and this post-October 7th, very, very challenging. Challenging is a euphemism for sometimes horrific and very, very difficult time of post-Simchat Torah, post-October 7th. And both the organizations or institutions with which I'm affiliated, Yad Vashem and IHRA, the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, are very much in, like the rest of the Jewish people and the rest of the world that has some sense of morality and ethics, in crisis. But I think, and this is something I actually spoke about in Glasgow at this conference, we are called upon, and I think it includes you as well, I hope what I'm about to say you identify with, we're called upon to move beyond the initial shock and chagrin and hand-wringing and move into a phase, not because we're happy, because we're not, and not even necessarily because we're optimistic, but because we're Jewish and we know we have the will and means to survive. So we need to move on, and I think many of us have, into the stage of, given that this is the situation, with all its deep, deep immorality and unfairness in the most profound way, what do we and can we do? And I think there are many organizations and fields of endeavor in the Jewish world and in the non-Jewish world, because we do have some allies left who are in that position. And that's really what I'd like to speak about this morning within the specific context of Holocaust remembrance. I those of you who are active in Yad Vashem UK, and maybe those of you who aren't as well, have always had an allegiance to Holocaust remembrance as something very central to our existence and identity as Jews. And I assume no one would say that because of what happened on October 7th and has happened since and continues to happen, changes that. However, there may be some who say, well, it's a matter of priorities and it's a matter of hierarchy of needs. And yes, there are certain standards or foundational principles and activities that we do as Jews in the modern world, such as Holocaust remembrance, that yes, we continue, but that's not what's critical now. And I certainly don't want to debate that. And if we're talking about what we can, how we can help our boys and women also as well, men and women who are at the front or in supporting positions in Israel, then, well, first of all, you might be surprised. There's Holocaust remembrance activities there as well. And many of them are continuing to receive, as they have over the decades, in Israel and in Tzahal, all kinds of Jewish identity, Israeli identity, training and reinforcement. It includes Holocaust remembrance. But that's not where I'm going today. I'm not going today as to how we can help them through Holocaust remembrance. That might be a different discussion. Which, by the way, we have at Yad Vashem with our various partners and with the Army. I'm thinking more about how we as non-combatants, whether in Israel or here or anywhere around the world, and again, I speak primarily for Jews, but also for those of the non-Jewish world that continue to have some openness and willingness to hear what our cause is, how can we and how can we continue to integrate, but perhaps I'll use a term, update or enhance or adjust or adapt Shoah remembrance to our current condition. Some of you might say, no, don't touch it. It's so sacrosanct, so holy, and so meaningful for me, for my family, for my community, that we should continue as we have had in the past, whether it's Yom HaShoah observances, whether it's seminars, meetings, etc. I respect that. I respect that. But part of what I'm here to share with you today, and that's really what I'm starting with now, is where the Holocaust Remembrance community, the global Holocaust Remembrance community, and there is such a community, part of it is defined in this organization, IRA, but there are other organizations and bilateral and multilateral associations between museums and schools and research institutes and between survivor organizations. So there is a community of people in Israel and abroad who are committed and very active and have gained a lot of experience and insight over the years to Holocaust remembrance. And what I am here to tell you is that you might say, who are you to say most of them? Well, so I haven't done a statistical study, but I really am in a position, I should say what I do in each organization, I will in just a moment, I'm in a position to gauge what the conversation is, both in Holocaust remembrance, Shoah remembrance in Israel, and in Jewish communities and organizations. I'm sure you are, some of you, in terms of the UK, but I can bring you some updates. So now I will say what I sort of said before. At Yad Vashem, I am Senior Advisor for International Affairs, so I don't generally go out and meet the dignitaries who come and help them lay their wreaths, but that's our protocol division, our official visits division, but I'm more behind the scenes at these official events, but very much in front of the scenes when we have, as we do, scores and scores, many, many yearly annual meetings, both in Israel and abroad, with governments and institutions and agencies that are in some way connected with Holocaust remembrance, be it in research or in testimony collection, documentation, Holocaust education, training teachers, and many, many diplomatic contacts through governments, ministries, etc. So that's what I do and have been doing for quite a few years at Yad Vashem. In IRA, which is part of what I do at Yad Vashem, I'm the co-head of the Israeli delegation. IRA consists of 35 member countries and another 8-9 international organizations, including the UK. When it got started in 2020, there were about 10 or 15, maybe 12 countries, including certainly Israel and the United Kingdom as well. It's grown to about 35 countries, which in itself is a reflection, I would say, of our pre-October 7th reality, and that is that many, many countries, I think some of them very candidly and genuinely, wanted to express in some manner, not necessarily that they identify with the Holocaust the way we as Jews do or the way we in the State of Israel do, but that they have a sense of the importance and meaning for their populations as non-Jews of the Shoah. Some of them did so, some of these newly joined countries, and most of the European countries belong to IRA and certain Canada, the United States, Australia, Argentina, there are some countries outside of Europe as well. I think they've joined both because out of a genuine sense that it's something worthy, and we'll talk in a few moments why and what they consider to be worthy and what that means now at this time. And also, there are political reasons as well. Certainly for the countries in Eastern Europe who joined IRA in the first decade after it was founded, as they were emerging from the Iron Curtain, it was to gain a sense of, or gain a perception of liberal democratic legitimacy, and that a country, a nation that wishes to show itself to be enlightened recognizes the Shoah. That's kind of paradoxical or even jarring when we think about it today. I wish it were so today in 2024. I think it's less so, although now in the Glasgow conference, there are still several countries, including Cyprus, which is small and near Israel and under Israeli influence. So you might say it's not surprising that Cyprus wants to join. They, by the way, have an interesting post-Holocaust aftermath narrative, which some of you may know. I'll give you an example which is indicative of our current condition. Turkey, which for years has been sitting on the fence and maintaining its observer status in IRA, which doesn't mean much. It means they pay a few thousand euros per year to send a delegate to these events, but they don't do much in terms of actual content of research, education, documentation, etc. They decided not to send a representative to Glasgow, and basically the organization understood that Turkey no longer has an interest in joining the international community of Holocaust remembrance. So that is an indication, I think, of where we are, sadly, in 2024, although some of you might say, well, good riddance to them. We don't want the Turks anyhow. And part of me says that as well, but to the extent that we are still somehow hopeful that at some point there will be Islamic countries and even Arab countries. And I will say that before October 7th, there were initial contacts, and I'm not saying anything that's very secret, it's kind of semi-secret. I can't say who was making these contacts. There were contacts with Morocco, which maintains a good relationship with its Jews and many of the Jews that have, and their descendants who've left Morocco, including their story, which they have enhanced a bit, about what their king did for the Jews during World War II. But in any case, what's again, sadly indicative of our times, that the contacts with Morocco have ended as well. So we're in a situation where much of what we had been hopeful about before October 7th, in terms of reaching out to the world and having them join us in some fashion in terms of Holocaust remembrance, has weakened. And this is something that we very, very much have talked about at IRA. As you can imagine, Israel has special status in this organization, unlike many international organizations, and I speak with Israeli diplomats who and also professionals in the areas of science and economics and what have you, Israelis and Jews, I think now to a certain extent, feel beleaguered and suspect and pressurized because of the situation. In IRA, fortunately, that is not the case yet, and you might as well, it certainly shouldn't be. I mean, you might say that in a righteous indignation. An organization that's devoted to Holocaust remembrance, of course they shouldn't be antagonistic towards Israel or to the Jewish people, and certainly the bon mot in IRA, their outward discourse is certainly pro-Jewish, and some of the countries, including, by the way, the UK representation in IRA, continue to be pro-Israel, but we see in some of the countries, as you might expect, and I'll name names. They know how I feel about them in IRA, and I expressed what I'm saying about to say to you now. I certainly expressed it in the hallways at the conference. Most of the Nordic countries, Belgium, Slovenia. Now I'm really naming names. Spain, under at least its current government, have even within IRA, even within an organization that's devoted to Holocaust remembrance, and part of its ritual is to, and I think also part of the sincere commitment of most of the non-Jewish members is to maintain, more than cordial, to maintain truly substantive, constructive contacts with the Jewish community. So even in IRA, these countries are now speaking this, I'd say, double entendre, half apologetic lingo of, and this is something I think many of you know, when people say, we can and should separate anti-Zionism from anti-Semitism. Of course we're against anti-Semitism, but anti-Zionism is a different thing. And within IRA they'll say, well, Israel and the war are political, so yes, we're all for remembering what happened in the Shoah and participating in all kinds of events to teach what happened in Auschwitz and Buchenwald, etc., etc., and what happened Kristallnacht, all the things that we know that are part of the basic core history of the Holocaust. So they'll say, yes, we teach the history of the Holocaust, and we teach something that I want to get into in just a few minutes, and that is the lessons of the Holocaust, but we don't do politics. Now, this is something, and clearly that's anti-Israeli, and it's clearly something that we need, in one way or another, to work against and to engage vigorously and fight against in as smart a fashion as we can, in as effective a fashion as we can. But I can assure you this, I never encountered this in Ireland before the war, before this current war. They may have thought it. I think many of you, and I myself, now we read these retrospective accounts of how in different countries that have different terminology. In North America, they talk about this woke intersectionality, and then there's the talk about the Qatari influence in academia, including, I think, in this country. And now looking back, people say, well, why didn't we see it? Or some people said, we did see it, and we warned you, but nothing was done, and I don't know what could have been done. But to the extent that these sentiments, that these trends of non-Jews, and of certain non-Jews, and certain governments, and certain sectors of world, of global opinion, that previously would never have apologized or had to be equivocal about their Holocaust remembrance, now do so. They now say, oh yes, we're all for Holocaust remembrance, but that doesn't mean that we're for what Israel does in Gaza. Now even that kind of sentence makes me sick. But I'll say as well that you guys don't have to do it. I have to do it. If you want to represent Israel and the Jewish people in the global conversation about Holocaust remembrance in 2024, you shouldn't make your peace with it, but you have to be willing to sit down and talk with these people. And it is difficult. I'll go back to something I said about 5 minutes ago, and that is, no, I don't think that this struggle, and it is a struggle, that we're conducting from Yad Vashem in the international sphere and other Holocaust organizations, and we have support from the Israeli government. We have support from some of the strong, good governments as well. And I'm being very, it may sound simplistic, but in this small, intimate gathering, I can be honest with you. So the good governments, I name some bad ones, so I'll name some good ones. Which also won't surprise you, at least currently the UK, the United States, Canada, Germany, Austria, there's several others, that Greece, Argentina, at least under this new rather interesting president that they have. I said Canada as well, for sure. So they are with us in vigorously countering what some of these equivocators are now saying about Shoah remembrance. I don't think that this struggle is, it's certainly not as dire in the physical sense of a physical endangerment as what is going on in the front, and including my own sons and son-in-law in Israel. Excuse me. Don't think about people you love when you're speaking publicly. So in any case, I don't think it's as dire as that. But for one thing, it's what I know how to do, and I do think, and I'm sure those of you who come here have come because Shoah remembrance is dear to you. And yes, it had relevance in the past 80 years. I think, if anything, and many of us do, not only Yad Vashem, but our allies in Iran and other international fora as well, think that all the more, it has all the more relevance today. If I may, because I have about another 10 minutes before I open up to Q&A, I wanted to note some dilemmas that existed. And even had you invited me here, I wish I could say had you invited me here today without the war, but let's say, be more realistic, had I come here a year ago, before the war broke out, I think I would have highlighted these dilemmas as well. I want to say each one of them, unfortunately, has become more critical and more problematic. Now, when I use the word dilemma, I don't mean obstacle, I don't mean problem, I mean my use of dilemma is when whatever you choose, you're paying a price and you may be doing something wrong and you have to make a difficult choice between two things that have a certain amount of rectitude or right to them. So the first dilemma, and again, this is something I've been speaking about for years, is whose Holocaust is it? And this is something that from the first moment, I think 10 years ago when I attended an IRA conference, and I heard how Slovaks and Canadians, I'm talking about non-Jews, and Brits and Danes and Finns and Poles, and they talk about the significance of Holocaust remembrance for them, and I said, I don't know if I really want to give it up. Because we know as Jews, there are differences of opinion and sentiment between us as well. We're Jewish, right? But I think there's a pretty, with all the differences amongst Jews, I think there's a great commonality as to what the Shoah means. You go out there to these other countries, they take it to other places. And sometimes they take it to places that, and again, I would have said this before the war as well, that we find disconcerting. Sometimes it just seems weird to me. They can take it to not to do bullying in a classroom. I mean, we go from what to Auschwitz to not bullying in a classroom, and then there's sometimes their excess emphasis on the righteous. We know we're just the few, pitifully few points of light in this vast darkness, and of course, non-Jews and non-Jewish governments have a. There are exceptions, but most of them, by the way, even the good ones, they want a feel-good Holocaust. And the feel-good Holocaust is the happy end Holocaust. And the happy end are not the 6 million victims. The happy end are these heroic non-Jews who helped. Again, it's not all non-Jews who behave this way, but many. So this was also a problem before October 7th. This issue of what happens when we say it's not just ours, it's not just our Shoah. We want the world. I know there are a few Jews and Israelis who say, "Look, Patli, I don't care. I don't want them to recognize anything. I'm Michael Tovis. I don't want them to. I don't need International Holocaust Remembrance Day. It's ours." Okay. I think most Jews don't feel that way. What many Jews don't realize, and I've realized in my position now for years, is as soon, and this is a dilemma, as soon as we say, "Learn about the Holocaust. Find what's relevant." When a human being searches for relevance, he looks in his own life, in his own biography, in his own culture, in his own people's history, and sometimes it takes them far away from what we considered to be the major lessons of the Holocaust. Now, that's certainly the case now, because I see now, I basically said this to you already, many of these governments are trying to take the Holocaust away. For instance, we know the most horrific, obscene approach that's called Holocaust inversion, when they say, "You guys who suffered the Holocaust, now you're doing one." That's the most obscene, and that we find primarily in Islamic anti-Semitism today. But some of the demonstrators you hear in this country and in other places around the world, around the democratic world. But there are more subtle ways. There are more subtle ways of saying, well, now post-war or during the war, and now that Israel is doing whatever it's doing, that we should talk about less Jewish aspects of the Holocaust, which in itself is preposterous and I think obscene. But I'm in certain contexts where I have to hear that and I have to respond. And obviously the response has to be firm. But if we want to have discourse with these people, we have to try to explain our position and not just shout it. Another dilemma, and here I'm not contradicting myself, and some of you may disagree with me. What I wrote was how to fight Holocaust distortion by others without committing it ourselves. Now, I certainly don't mean that anything we do in the field vis-a-vis the non-Jewish world is anything... there's nothing that has to do with the Shoah, nothing whatsoever. But, and this is something, what I'm about to say, it's perfectly legitimate for you to disagree with, and this has come up a lot in Israel, certainly in the first 2 months after Simchat Torah, when so many Israelis, either those who had been in those horrific attacks, or who had friends or relatives or dear ones, certainly you may know that some of them were Nitzolei Shoah, Holocaust survivors themselves, and they happened to be in these invaded, raped communities. And they said, well, it brings me back to what happened in the ghetto. It brings me back to what happened in the camps. And then you hear, or we heard, and certainly in the Israeli media, it's just like Auschwitz, it's just like Babi Yar, it's just, again, Jewish children are hiding in the closet. Okay. At Yad Vashem, we had to deal with this. And just the way I was honest with you before, I'll be honest now. I consider it personally a form of Holocaust distortion. Not the kind, chas v'shalom, that the goyim do, but it's not something that we should engage in. I think we need to be precise and specific about when we talk about the Shoah, and when we talk about its meaning to us today, we have to be very careful for our own Jewish discourse and also for what goes out to the world. And the world listens, as you know, and they watch and they distort about what we say. So, at Yad Vashem, at least, we say we understand and we feel ourselves that what happened on October 7th and to a great extent what continues to happen now is reminiscent of certain aspects, particularly of the lead up into the Shoah. But as I'm sure you've had this conversation here as well, it's vital to emphasize, and certainly when we deal, and as we do in Yad Vashem with, when we teach and discuss. Now, during the war, Israeli soldiers and officers from Tzahal, we don't tell them, and nor do we want them to feel that it's just like the Shoah. They are the vivid proof that it's not just like the Shoah. But yes, there are things which remind us. And yes, not to use the word Shoah, but to use the word genocide. What Hamas did to us was a genocidal attack and with genocidal intent. And that is something that we certainly say and we in IRA have said and continues to say. And yes, I see which governments agree and use, they adopt our terminology, and I see which governments don't. And it's a battle. And I think, if anything, it's going to continue to be harder. The final dilemma I want to note here, and I think it's kind of been subliminal in everything I've said until now, and this is certainly a dilemma. And in fact, depending on where I am, on which day, or sometimes which time of the day, I not only can argue both sides, I do both sides. And that is, to what extent is Holocaust remembrance an end in and of itself, intrinsically, inherently, that we remember the Holocaust in all the ways we do because it's the right thing to do in and of itself, that those 6 million and the survivors and everything that they died for and those who survived, everything they lived for, merit remembrance apart from anything else that goes on in the Jewish people. That's one side of the dilemma. The other is, to what extent is it legitimate, and some would say even necessary, to use and I can't find a better word in the English language, leverage, utilize, integrate. Maybe that's the most part of a way of saying it, to integrate Holocaust themes and facts and stories and personalities for other purposes, such as combating contemporary anti-Semitism. This is a perennial dilemma for anyone who deals, well, I don't know for anyone, but certainly for Yad Vashem, certainly for those who support Holocaust remembrance on a global level. When do we, I really don't want to be cynical because it's not a subject I feel cynical about. I don't want to say when do we play the Holocaust card. When do we integrate Holocaust messaging into our struggles for other things that are also dear and important to the Jewish people? It's a risk. It is a risk because what often happens, and yes, it's not, and it's not justifiable, but when... such as fighting anti-Semitism, such as defending the State of Israel today. And you quote the Holocaust in order to do that. If we don't want to have another Holocaust, you have to be for Israel. What these demonstrators are doing in central London, that's like what the Nazis did in 1938. It's a double-edged sword to do that. And when, I will tell you, when we do it, and again, I said, it depends what time of the day it is. Sometimes I support it, but I support it carefully and selectively because it opens us up to the to real emistic Holocaust distortion. People say, "Well, you can quote the Holocaust, you can relate to what happened, so why can't we?" Obviously, there are answers to that. We say we do it accurately, and they don't do it inaccurately. But as most of you know, in this deeply frustrating, confounding world we live in of these distorted bits of factoids that go out on social media and are often mouthed by leaders and by influencers, you don't have a second. You don't have another chance to say, "Oh, well, you quoted that, but it's inaccurate. You quoted it out of context." So we have to be very careful and considered when we bring the Holocaust into contemporary Jewish issues. As again, I think we should. You need to do it in a very deft and adept and I'll even say professional manner. And something we try to do both at Yad Vashem and at IRA. I think I will end now in terms of what I was going to. My monologue, and I'm opened up to questions and comments.
Concentrating on the last thing you said, or the last thing you said just now, was using the Shoah and the stories of the Shoah, the facts from the Shoah, for other purposes. But we use the phrase, and the other show used the phrase, never again. So there has to be, it's not just a history lesson. Holocaust remembrance can't just be history, because that's just facts and figures, especially for the Jewish community. So surely, again, it's a crude use of the word "use," but using the Shoah itself going forward as lessons for the future—that's important, as important as a history.
I certainly agree. Two responses. Three. The first is that I agree with you in terms, you said it as a general statement, and I certainly agree with that. And I think most people who engage in genuine Holocaust remembrance today agree with that. The question is how it's done. There are all kinds of ways I think it's very legitimate to speak, for instance, how we draw inspiration from the resilience, from the courage, from the resourcefulness, from the commitment of the heroes of the Shoah in our time today, I'm all for that, and we do so, to teach specific stories, but saying it's not the same. In other words, I would be very, very careful about, and I think, at least in Israel, and I think in the diaspora as well, to teach Jewish youngsters today about what Jews not only endured, but what they did to express their resistance, to resist. We have to be very careful about which examples we give when we compare. And one of the linguistic basics of our conversation and has always been is what's the difference between comparing and equating? It's okay to compare between the holidays. By the way, this is in general in history. The study of history is all about comparing, but compare are similarities and differences. To equate is to say it's the same. I would say to use or to integrate Holocaust messages is absolutely legitimate and even called for, but to equate anything we're going to through today with the Holocaust is in the end a shooting ourselves in the foot. I think it's also doing a disservice to everyone. It's doing a disservice to everyone. I know we have at least my hostess from Stanmore, Ilana Metzger, but there may be others here as well who are children of survivors. With all the horror of what people went through in the Gaza periphery, and even our own soldiers, and you ask the soldiers, they'll tell you this. These great heroes, what they have endured is nothing in these past 8 months is nothing like what happened in the Shoah in even one day, in terms of the magnitude of Jewish suffering and both in terms of quantity and in terms of the fact that the Jews had no hope whatsoever and no real ability to defend themselves, which is totally different. So, which is why we really have to be very careful about how we do it. In addition to the fact that the Goyim then say, well, you use the Holocaust, so can we. And who's to say you're using it any better or any more accurately than we do? Yeah.
I understand. A similar vein to Richard's question. I understand your rejection of the description of the October 7th as a Holocaust-type event. I was struggling to find out how I could portray that event to other people, and the closest I came was a pogrom.
Yes.
How relevant do you think that is from your perspective of assessing how to describe that terrible event rather
right.
than a massacre?
It's certainly relevant.
Or how a friend of mine described it most horrifically as a form of resistance, which is...
Who resisted? The Jews?
No. Arab resistance.
Oh, that's...
I mean, that was reprehensible.
Right. Those are two different questions. To describe... Unless they say, and some of them do, if anyone, doesn't matter who it is, says that what, not only the Arabs are undergoing some kind of genocide, or that they are like the Jews during the Holocaust, then you might be skeptical and say, so what? But then we have them. It's like, you know, when the district attorney and the lawyer or the judge says, well, if they say that, then we have them. Any use of Holocaust imagery to describe what Arabs are enduring today is not only by the IRA definition of anti-Semitism and Holocaust distortion, but by the United Nations unanimously adopted resolution about Holocaust distortion. They basically took over the IRA resolution. It was during COVID. It was about 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago. By the way, it was accepted by acclamation. Only one country refused to join the acclamation, Iran, which actually did us a service. Because anyone today who says they don't accept that resolution, they say, okay, that's your company. Your company is Iran. Anyhow, any use of that kind of imagery to describe what Israel is doing, we can say is Holocaust distortion. Now, you can say, all right, so what? You've called it Holocaust distortion. They don't care. You call it anti-Semitism. They don't care. But there are still a vast amount of people. I think some of them are your neighbors or your colleagues or associates, non-Jews, and maybe, sadly, some Jews as well, who are sitting on the fence, who are confused, who say, well, maybe there is something to that Holocaust imagery. So there are ways, I invite you all to either enter the Yad Vashem website or the IRA website or I have my card here. I'll be glad to provide you with some of these responses. As I said, Yad Vashem is not in the central, nor should be, should it be in the central Israeli information endeavor to defend what our, what we're doing in Gaza or what we may be doing up north. But we are very central in the current Israeli and Jewish fight to prevent this war and its horrors from becoming a potential boon to the anti-Semites. So in anything having to do with Holocaust distortion or denial, I can be of assistance. Yes?
I'll kind of make a statement and then maybe a suggestion if I may rather than a question, but I'm just thinking with the struggle before October 7th to get universal definitions agreed, it seems to me that anti-Semitism has morphed again into a kind of genocide chant against us that's been universally accepted by the majority of the woke elite in the West. It almost feels like they're so desperate to distort the situation to the point that the Holocaust becomes an irrelevancy.
Mm.
Education inside schools and other places before the war seemed to be an inevitability, but now I'm not so sure. So whilst we're able to get educational institutions to discuss our Holocaust, I fear that that will only happen as long as we talk about the genocide that went on in Gaza in a few years' time. So my opinion is we have to utilise the non-Jewish voices as they are seemingly more powerful than our own. We've seen, or I've certainly felt, that there's no...
More powerful or more objective?
No, more powerful.
Okay.
I mean, when I listen to someone like Douglas Murray,
mm-hmm.
and I kind of wish we could amplify him, you know...
Clone him.
...a thousand times. There's very few. When you listen to him, that for some reason seems more powerful to me, and I'm sure to other voices around, to other minds around the world. And I'm wondering whether or not there is some work to be done within the non-Jewish communities to bring in some voices to your organisation to continue that fight, because I feel that people will take them, unfortunately, but it may not be the truth, but it just feels this way, that they will have a more powerful voice going forward.
I'd like to respond. I agree with a lot of what you said, but just to respond to the last thing you said, he's not Douglas Murray, nor does he purport to be, but I will name a major, at least some of you have heard of him, non-Jewish figure who in our context, and not only this year, for years, has been very vocal and I think effective as a spokesman, and that's Lord Eric Pickles, who is both the UK government's envoy for combating anti-Semitism, but he's also this year the British chair of IHRA. And I'm sure, unlike some of his predecessors in IHRA, he will continue to be very involved even when he steps down from this particular position. By the way, Israel is due to be, again, this was planned way before. It was one of my initiatives about 3-4 years ago. I was looking through the calendar and I said, 2025, that's 80 years since the end of the Shoah, and Israel hasn't been president of IHRA since 2010. The time has come, and we pushed it through. I want to say to you, I have to say to you, sadly, I believe today we would not be confirmed by all that. We were confirmed by acclamation 3 years ago, 2 years ago when we took this on. I think today some of those countries I mentioned up in the Scandinavian countries and elsewhere might say, oh, it's too political for Israel. Why don't you wait a few years? And I had someone, fortunately, she's very much in the minority, someone British, came up to me now in Glasgow who said, I love Israel. And then I waited for the but, and that was the next word. But my travel insurance won't let me come to Jerusalem next year. Now, she has already decided that next year we'll still be at war and that she won't be allowed to come. So she said, so have you considered finding an alternative venue for your Israeli presidency? She's an academic, by the way. And I think it's not coincidental, because I found many of the education and museum people in IHRA, non-Jews, to be more supportive than the academics. And I said to her, I didn't want you to come to Israel because you love Israel. And I said, I don't even care if you love Israel. Israel occupies a central role in Holocaust remembrance. We have stellar, unsurpassed resources, both at Yad Vashem and elsewhere. It's, no one denies the centrality of Israel in Holocaust remembrance. That's why you, as a Holocaust researcher, should be coming here next year. And no, we're not considering any alternative venue. This is not the European basketball championships, and we're not going to have it in Budapest. Nothing takes the place of Jerusalem. So she said, oh, I didn't mean. But she did mean. And, but that's those are the kinds of comments we may be receiving. Of course, if I were to tell Lord Pickles, and I may, I just didn't have the opportunity last week, that this was someone on his delegation said this, I assume he'll give her the boot. But that might not be the right thing to do.
Just to clarify what I was saying at the end there, so take Lord Pickles as an example. I actually had a breakfast with him at a Yad Vashem event in central London a few years ago. I have honestly not seen one single soundbite or one piece from Lord Pickles myself. And I've seen a lot of stuff. And my wife tries to get me on social media all the time. I've seen a huge amount of stuff. I've seen zero.
All right, listen, I'm not his PR person, I'm not defending him. I'll send you some things that I've received.
We need to, our responsibility in your organization is to amplify those voices.
Yes.
If it's not okay,
I'm here to listen as well. I'll take this back to Jerusalem and to Ira. Yes.
If we get further and further away from the Holocaust in terms of chronology, are you confronted with the argument that our genocide is somehow being treated as special, maybe because it's Eurocentric?
No, they say it's Judeo-centric.
Or Judea.
Oh, you mean perhaps from in Africa or Southeast Asia? That, honestly, I mean, it's not that I've never encountered that potential argument, but no, but that is not very dominant, nor the Eurocentric aspect, nor have I seen it more prevalently since the war broke out. What they will say, and this is a term used in other contexts as well, you may know in the social sciences and history, there will be voices who will say, why do you have to insist on Jewish exceptionalism? Exceptionalism is whenever you want to say someone says he's special and you want to say he's not. But I think we're so fortunate in Ira, even amongst the more anti-Israeli ones, for their own interests and reasons, they still will say that the Holocaust is the most extreme case in human history of total, systematic, planned, lengthy genocide. And also of a, and what I'm about to say is not included necessarily in the term genocide, at least not in, as Lemke originally envisaged it in 1946, and that is that the intention in the case of the Nazis was to not only obliterate all the Jews, but to obliterate their culture and civilization and values. And there are very few other genocide is a horrible thing no matter what. But I read a lot of literature, but I am personally not an expert in genocide studies. There are very few, if any, other genocides in which that's the case. Yes.
What was the premise of creating the IRA? And you mentioned it was only in 2020?
Yes. No, it was founded in 2000.
Okay.
They're now, it'll be their 25th anniversary soon.
And how did it come about in terms of, was it a governmental approach? I mean, you had to actually lobby governments or...
Okay. I was not at Yad Vashem then. I came to Yad Vashem in 2007, so it was already in existence about 7 years. Since then, I've been relatively active. IRA, which was originally called the International Task Force, ITF, for Holocaust Remembrance, was an immediate outgrowth an intentional outgrowth of what is known, and you can check all this in Google, you can see it on the IRA website, the Stockholm Declaration of 1999. The then Prime Minister of Sweden, Göran Persson, who's still alive and is still very much not only pro-Holocaust remembrance but pro-Israel, he was very shocked at the time, genuinely so. And that's because Sweden has, or had then, a large Jewish... It's not like an American president who's thinking about the vote in Brooklyn or in Florida. He was generally shocked by some outbreaks of anti-Semitism there. And then in 1999, it was not yet Islamic. It wasn't yet Malmo, as we know it to be, this, you know, little whatever, little Marrakesh in Malmo, or little Damascus. It was right-wing neo-fascist punks performing anti-Semitic acts, and there was a survey then of how few Swedish young people knew anything about World War II or about the Holocaust. So, and then he was in contact with several other like-minded progressive democratic, well, not progressive the way we mean it today, liberal democratic leaders, including at the time Bill Clinton, I think Tony Blair then. If we're talking 1999, 2000, he was PM then here. He gathered, and he his major Jewish contact, although others joined, was Elie Wiesel, and he decided to have an international conference in Stockholm. They drafted a resolution about, and it was the first of its kind, in which they said that mankind, not the Jewish people, mankind must remember the Holocaust, and it must be done through fact-based testimony, historical research, education, and commemoration, museums, exhibits, displays, and so forth, and that a permanent international organization be set up. And 1 year later, in Stockholm, he hosted the first meeting of, as I said, it was only called IRA, it's been called IRA for about 7 years, 8 years, but and it was basically IRA, just with a different name. As I said, it was founded with about 15 countries, and over the past 20, 25 years, other countries have joined. I'll tell you, IRA can sometimes be frustrating. Has nothing to do with what I've talked about till now, you know, hidden anti-Zionism or even encroaching anti-Semitism, because it can sometimes be frustrating for the reason any of you who belong to organizations know. There's a lot of bureaucracy and protocol and committees. And for instance, this year I'm the chair of the Museum and Memorial Committee of IRA, which I think is doing some good work, and I can sing my own praises and tell you some things I think that were valuable, important in Glasgow, and that we'll be doing. Oh, we'll be back here in London in Bezrat Hashem in early December for the London plenary of IRA. I hope by then you'll be hearing more from Lord Pickles and his staff. But there were, and so we do. I think IRA does some very valuable things. But yes, there's a lot of process, and when you put together governmental representatives, these 35 countries all represent the offices of their heads of state, whether it's a prime minister, president, sometimes a king or a monarch, or ministries of education, mainly foreign ministries, ministries of culture, whoever is in charge of Holocaust remembrance in that country. And they bring in their academic museum educational experts, and the survivor communities are now the second or third gen communities in those countries in which it's relevant. So it's in that case, in that sense, not a unique, but it's one of the few organizations in the world on any subject which has groups of people from groups of professionals from very different backgrounds, and that in itself I find fascinating. It has nothing to do with fighting against forgetting the Holocaust, but it is very interesting to have in the room diplomats, politicians, researchers, educators, and curators, archivists, who are all, at least supposedly, and I think in most cases, truly committed to many of the same goals.
Yossi, I'd just like to use the opportunity now to thank you very much for coming today. We look forward to maybe seeing you again in December.
Okay, that would be great.
Another chat, man. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you all.